joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new study shows that palliative care can not only improve the quality of life for those suffering serious or terminal illness, it can even extend it. This study, which looked at patients suffering from terminal lung cancer, appears in the latest issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Joining me in the studio to talk about the wider implications, Dr. Diane Meyer of the Center to Advance Palliative Care. Good morning to you, Dr. Meyer.
Good morning, Diane.
Thanks for joining us. And Christina Tafe. She's with the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Diane.
From a studio at Harvard University Medical School, Dr. Atul Gawande of The New Yorker. Good morning, sir. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
And also joining us by phone from her office at Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Jennifer Temel. She's lead author of the new study on palliative care. Good morning, Dr. Temel.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And throughout the hour, I'll invite your calls. This is a fascinating study with really enormous implications. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us by email. You can send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Let me start with you, if I could, Dr. Temel. Explain to us just what is palliative care and why you decided to take the approach you did on this study.
Well, the main results of our study were that early palliative care improves quality and quantity of life for metastatic lung cancer patients. And the reason we undertook this study is because patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer not only have a very short life expectancy of less than a year, but they have an incredibly high symptom burden beginning at the time of diagnosis, which persists throughout the course of their disease. And these symptoms include pain, shortness of breath, fatigue, and depression. So what we demonstrated is that patients who received early palliative care had substantial improvements in their quality of life. They had 50% lower rates of depression than patients not receiving palliative care, and also had almost a three-month survival benefit from these services.
But Dr. Meyer, explain to us exactly what is meant by palliative care.
Palliative care is an approach to health care that focuses on the quality of the patient's and the family's life. So it aims to identify and treat symptoms such as pain and shortness of breath, to make sure that patients and families have a real understanding of their illness and what it means and what to expect in the future and what their options are, because there's usually multiple options for treatment, and what the pros and cons of those treatment options are, and then helps them to make the best decisions for them over the course of an illness. And then, as importantly, and it's demonstrated in Jennifer's study, these people get care that follows them away from the doctor's office and away from the hospital. They can reach someone who knows them and can help them at any hour of the day or night, 7 days a week. And what that does is prevent crises and prevent disasters and prevent the need to call 911 or go to the emergency department or go to the hospital. And I think that's probably a major contributor to the longer life that the patients in Jennifer's study had.
So turning to you, Christina Tafe, as a palliative care nurse practitioner, what does that mean for you? What kinds of additional, perhaps, responsibilities are there? How does your palliative care differ from that offered to any patient through a nurse practitioner?
I work in a busy cancer center at Georgetown Lombardi Cancer Center, and so we see cancer patients, all different kinds of cancers. And so one of the things that palliative care does and I can help with is giving some control to patients who often have lost control over where their life's heading. You know, the trajectory of the disease is unknown sometimes. There's complications that may arise, the side effects of treatment, and these begin to affect someone's ability to function and really alter their role in society and within their family. And this really can add to depression and cause someone to question their self-worth. So what I can do as a nurse practitioner along with my colleague physicians is really help give these patients the tools and the power to control some of their quality of life. And like Diane said, you know, to decrease those crises as far as having knowing that we're there to help them and having that backup. And so that fear of being alone during those crises is gone. And so we may not be able to stop how the disease is going to progress, but we can make that time be as peaceful and as the most quality as possible. And so we give them some power back in an often uncontrollable situation.
Dr. Gawande, were you surprised at the results of this study?
I wasn't. I mean, I come at this as a surgeon who really didn't understand more than, you know, hospice or palliative care were the people that we might turn to at the very end. And it was almost something that you'd hand the patients off and they'd disappear. The study helped make clear something that I only discovered in the course of writing about how badly we take care of people at the end of life. And what it suggested is that we're not good at helping people live a good life with a terminal illness and come to key decisions that they have to make in a smart and appropriate way. And so in the course of writing about the ways that the care goes so badly, it was clear there were ways that things could go very, very well. And so it was amazing to see this really blockbuster study demonstrate through a randomized trial that people who got someone to talk with them about when to let go, at the same time that they were also thinking through with their oncologist the chemotherapy, they didn't have to give up those things, that they ended up choosing more successfully when to let go.
And that's what I want to go back to in this study, Dr. Timmel. What you were doing was not sort of deciding that one group would have everything they wanted and one group would have nothing. What you were doing was giving one group everything they wanted in the way of medical care plus palliative care, and the other group had every medical treatment they wanted except for palliative care. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think that's really one of the strengths of this study is that all of the lung cancer patients received state-of-the-art cancer treatment. Their cancer treatment, whether that meant chemotherapy or radiation, wasn't altered at all by participating in the study. So I think one of the important messages is that expert cancer care and palliative care aren't mutually exclusive. Patients can receive state-of-the-art cancer care at a large hospital or academic medical institution and at the same time receive palliative care services. And not only is that feasible, but it's also incredibly beneficial.
Dr. Timmel, how did the patients you approached to participate in this study react to the proposal?
You know, we actually didn't have issues having patients agree to participate in the study. Our accrual rate was over 50%, so more than half of the patients we approached for the study agreed to participate. And I think the real issue is that clinicians have to become comfortable talking about palliative care and explaining what it means. And if we can educate clinicians that palliative care is not synonymous with hospice or end-of-life care and educate them what the purpose of palliative care is, they can then effectively communicate that to the patients, and the patients are agreeable to accept these services if we just spend a little bit of upfront time explaining what their role is.
Dr. Meyer, that's truly key, is it not? That is having physicians trained to understand palliative care.
Yeah, I think the fact that physicians in general have not been trained both to practice palliative care within their own skill set. So, for example, I believe that every pediatrician and internist and surgeon and family medicine doc should know and be able to practice the basics of symptom assessment and symptom treatment, should be trained in having conversations about the goals of care and what to expect with patients and families, and should understand the health system outside the walls of his or her office or the hospital so that they can help patients negotiate this. Unfortunately, at this time, most doctors and nurses are not well trained in
these
skills. It simply has not been part of the curriculum.
I see.
And I think part of that is because of our entrancement or enchantment in this country with modern technology,
yes.
Drugs, devices, procedures, as you know, we used to say about surgeons, a chance to cut is a chance to cure. Certainly the same is true across other medical specialties. And what has happened de facto is we've lost sight of the whole person, the human being that is living with these usually multiple illnesses or problems.
Dr. Diane Meyer, she's director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. And Dr. Jennifer Temel, I want to thank you so much for joining us. She is assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and lead author in the study of palliative care on terminal lung cancer patients. Thanks again for joining us. Short break, right back. Welcome back, and we're talking about new study in the New England Journal of Medicine, just published by our guest who was on with us earlier this morning, Dr. Jennifer Temel at the Harvard Medical School. It was a study of palliative care on terminal lung cancer patients. But Dr. Gawande, I gather that now researchers will be looking at other types of diseases to see whether palliative care has the same outcome.
I think that's right. I mean, understand the people you've got gathered around the microphones here. These doctors and nurses are pioneers. They are helping us take a second look again at what great medicine looks like, in this case, for people with terminal illness. And you know, what we have imagined about how the end comes has changed. You know, for centuries, death was swift. It came on like bad weather. It was something you either got through or you didn't. And now medicine can offer everything from feeding tubes to tracheostomies to ventilators and chemotherapy and pacemakers. And when you... most of us are going to end our days with a terminal illness, and it's not just cancer. It's congestive heart failure. It's dementia. It's liver disease. There will be some illness that will not be curable, but will be, a doctor will tell you, treatable. We have envisioned that what you do is just battle, that you fight. What they're showing is that there comes a point where the fight with technology can cause you harm, can make it so you can't achieve the things you really want in life. You know, not just time, but time with family, avoiding suffering, getting to get to that bucket list you might have. And unless people in medicine learn how to make that kind of great medicine for the terminally ill patient, we're failing people. And these are the guys who are learning how to do it.
Dr. Atul Gawande, he's staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and associate professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. Here is our first comment from Facebook. It's from Joseph, who says, what is the difference between palliative care and hospice care? Is hospice care what the death panels were about? Christina Tafe.
That's a good question, and that's one of the misconceptions that palliative care and hospice are the same thing. They both focus on maximizing quality of life, but they're used differently. Palliative care, really, we're focusing on eliminating symptoms and side effects, giving control over these symptoms, and allowing people to have better quality of life. People, while undergoing chemotherapy, undergoing radiation, or any kind of treatment to try to prolong life or to cure disease, are going to have complications and side effects that alter quality of life. So we are helping to limit these while they're undergoing treatment. And ultimately, if we can help with increasing the patient's functional status and giving them the strength and ability to fight the disease, that's ultimately going to help them. Now, in hospice, people are generally have made the decision that they are focusing on comfort care, and that at this stage in their life, either the treatment is no longer working and they want to focus on a good quality of life, whether that be weeks, whether that be months, and they're just focusing on managing those symptoms.
Now, is that decision to stop focusing on medicine, technology, every kind of medical device imaginable, and the move to hospice care, is that usually made in conjunction with the patient and the physician and the family?
Yes, it's a combination of it's with the family, with the patient, with any other provider they're involved with, social workers. It's really a group discussion, and it's not something that happens in one discussion. That's why early palliative care discussions, when you first meet the patient, this is a continuing discussion as condition changes. And so we want to do these early on. So we go ahead.
Go ahead, Dr. Meyer.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that this discussion thus far has focused on terminal illness, because the patient population in the New England Journal of Medicine study had advanced lung cancer. That is a group that has a prognosis of around a year
right.
with best cancer
right.
care. But I think it's important for everybody to understand that palliative care is not limited to the terminally ill, and its benefit is as important in people with chronic debilitating illnesses who are not terminal and who may live for years.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
For example, heart failure or emphysema or dementia. All of these diseases cause tremendous burdens on patients and families, really badly affect quality of life, cause symptom distress, depression, emotional upset, huge burdens of work for families, not only financially, but also emotionally and physically and socially. And as Atul mentioned, these are no longer rapid death sentences. People may live for years, sometimes decades, with any one of these severe illnesses. And palliative care is crucial to help people retain some control over quality of life, over decisions, over what they want when crises inevitably happen in the future. It is not limited to the terminally ill. Hospice is limited to the terminally ill.
So, Dr. Gawande, going back to Joseph's question, how did we get from palliative care to hospice care to death panels? How did that come about?
Well, I think that was politics. The fight against the health reform package that was under debate last year zeroed in on a set of provisions that would have allowed clinicians to be compensated for what are inherently long and serial conversations with someone who is facing an incurable illness, like a severe congestive heart failure or a metastatic lung cancer. And that set of discussions, which are focused on not how do we sacrifice your body now for the sake of time later through surgery or chemotherapy, you know, the kinds of things that I generally focus my practice on, but instead on asking what kind of life do you want now and how we support it if that means even giving up on surgery or a chemotherapy at this point. That was construed as a death panel. And, you know, there were people who were simply taking advantage of a political atmosphere when it's not hard to demagogue the issue. But I can tell you, you know, in the course of writing my article a year after the death panel charges came out, where I walked through the story of a 34-year-old woman diagnosed with a metastatic lung cancer during her 9th month of pregnancy. The fascinating thing was when I started talking to these palliative care experts to teach me, you know, what is the way that we could have taken better care of her? Because I was one of her doctors and I saw the end and it wasn't what it should have been. And the discussion with several of palliative care doctors was, in this atmosphere, please don't write this article. That people, it will be twisted, it will be changed, and it will set us back. You know, that the death panel's discussion felt like it set back the progress of the field by a decade, people felt, and that if I put in the New Yorker more about this, that it could set us back another decade if it becomes political dynamite. But my sense of it was we were at a point where we were just tired of death panel fight. And everybody is going through this. Everybody has a mother, father, spouse, family member who is going through or about to go through an incurable illness that is not being well cared for
under
the current system.
Now, here's another question from Jonathan, who's here in Washington, D.C. He says, what is the difference in patient healthcare costs between palliative care and other end-of-life care options? What is the reimbursement for hospitals from palliative care? Are there reasons palliative care is not more widespread? Dr. Meyer.
Well, actually, that's an excellent question, and there have been a number of studies that have looked at the impact of palliative care on healthcare spending, and not surprisingly, because people feel better and they remain at home and are able to retain control over what's happening and make decisions in advance and don't end up in the ER and don't end up in ICUs, it's cheaper. But the goal is not saving money. The goal is respecting and listening to the patient. Actually, the second part of the question is why isn't this more widely available is also interesting because, in fact, if you look at the larger hospitals in the United States, those with more than several hundred beds, over 80% now have palliative care programs. Why don't patients access them? Primarily because their doctors don't call us in. It's not that the programs aren't there. It's not that people like us aren't available. It's that their physicians have not been trained to understand that palliative care is not the same as end-of-life care, that palliative care is an important partner to disease treatment or curative efforts, and that we basically join the team and help the patient and family manage this illness as best they can. So talk to your doctor. Tell your doctor you know that there's probably a palliative care program at his or her hospital and you would like to have them involved early because the studies show you'll live longer.
But what about cost, Christina?
You know, when we get involved with patient care and start managing our patient's symptoms, we definitely see a decrease in their return to the ER, their admissions to the hospital. You know, instead of going to the emergency room because they're short of breath, we've already worked out a plan on how to treat that at home. And if it's not working well, they call us, we talk over the phone, we save them a trip from coming all the way back to the hospital to see us because we know it's hard for them. And so we decrease their returning. And so we really can decrease their need for acute care in the home, by treating them in the home.
But surely there's got to be some cost involved here. How does reimbursement work in the case of a palliative care nurse or a palliative care doctor when the individual is in the home? Christina.
Well, unfortunately, we don't get reimbursed for phone calls and following up of the phone, but really our focus is maximizing that person's quality of life, and I'm not going to make them come in to see me if I can talk to them for 5 minutes. But in reality, we're not being reimbursed for most of the care we do.
Christine Tave, she is a palliative care nurse practitioner at the Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center at Georgetown University Hospital. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Gawande, is there a resistance on the part of doctors to become involved in palliative care because they continue to want to use every bell and whistle at their available to them? And is that why fewer doctors are aware of and practice palliative care?
I don't think it's quite as black and white as that. I think the reason why we're not very good at really caring for the terminally ill patients in the mainstream is because partly what Diane talked about, we aren't well trained in how to reach a recognition of when it's time to really let go and advise a patient on how to meet their needs for palliation rather than that fourth round of chemotherapy, which probably does more harm than good. Second, the economics that you talk about. We are structured and paid for, I get paid for the surgery I do. I get paid pretty well for that, compared to taking the hour it would take to sit down with the patient and then maybe a follow-up hour with their family who's really struggling with this decision over not doing an operation. I had this weekend a family who has an obstruction, a woman who has an obstruction of her intestine from a colon cancer that has not responded to chemotherapy. And, you know, it was 2 hours of discussion with different family members over coming to a decision to not operate. And this is not something that's well reimbursed. And for many of the people that are doing it, which has the added in phone calls and emails and things like that that have to be done, that was what some of the discussion about adding that reimbursement in. So you get to the cost question. There are some costs and people associated with doing this work well. But the costs of care for people when it's done badly, when we've not been able to meet their needs, it actually mounts. It not only makes their life worse, but we worsen the effects on the healthcare system
itself. I see. All right. Let's open the phones. Caller in Miami, Florida. Good morning, Joe. I gather you are an MD.
Correct. I am an MD. I've also had extensive experience with the palliative care pathway for a lot of patients, and I was also involved in an innovative medical training program where we actually experienced training both in the hospice suites and at patients' home with palliative care nurses as part of our training. I just wanted to comment on, you know, the underlying issue here. I read the New England Journal every time it comes out, and I've really seen a slant now. And this article about the palliative care of lung cancer patients just kind of put the icing on the cake. Before that, it was Ezekiel Emanuel writing articles about how healthcare reform is going to save lots of money. There seems to be a push now in academic medicine to go ahead and cost-justify healthcare reform at the expense, I think, of the patient. And there is a portrayal of doctors as these greedy businessmen trying to slam and jam one more surgery or one more defibrillator into a patient that has very little time left to live. And culturally, this country has a very hard time addressing death, and doctors still want to feel like at the end of it all, we've helped somebody stay alive. Death is a final experience that, there's really nothing else on the side of that.
All right, Joe, I do want to have Dr. Meyer respond.
Joe, I also am a clinician, and I also practice medicine, and I also feel very much the need to treat disease and help people live as long as possible. But this study and others like it show that focusing on the patient and being patient-centered actually prolongs life better
than usual care. Dr. Diane Meyer, she's director at the Center to Advance Palliative Care at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. And here's an email from a palliative care nurse whose name is Jane. She says, I frequently suggest to our attending doctors that patients have a consult with the hospital palliative care team, a very competent, well-developed program at our hospital. Their reluctance for a consult, however, is palpable. The answer is frequently, well, let's first get text X or procedure X before calling them. It's so difficult to get these doctors to go from a curative position to a position of comfort. As nurses, we see the suffering patients and families experience for our entire shift. What would you suggest for nurses working as the go-between of patients and doctors to get doctors to understand that palliative care does not equate to the grim reaper? What would your response be, Christina?
That's an excellent question. So first, trying to find out why there is the delay in getting palliative care, maybe some education, which might be challenging to do from a nurse to an attending, but just finding out why. Also, using, contact.
Have you encountered that situation personally?
Yes, it happens quite often, I think all over, and sometimes it's the common is, well, they're still trying to fight the disease. We're not ready to bring in palliative care. And so that goes back to the misconception of what palliative care is. So we educate. We educate that resident who then, from that point on, hopefully is now aware of what palliative care is and is spreading the word. And so education is key.
Dr. Meyer, what would you suggest?
I really like Christina's answer, which is to press. Why do you feel this patient's not ready for palliative care yet? And then when they say, well, this person's not dying, then we say palliative care is not restricted to the dying. Palliative care is to help maximize quality of life and function for this patient and family. And that, when you take the time to actually ask your colleague to articulate their thinking about why it's not time yet, you can often get them to understand that their perception is too narrow about what palliative care's benefits are. That's not always true, but there's gradual, slow, increasing acceptance among physicians. But
All
we
right.
have a long way to go.
Let's go now to Aaron, who's in Buffalo, New York. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm actually a practicing palliative care physician in upstate New York, and in our state, Governor Patterson just actually signed the Palliative Care Information Act last week that would require that physicians discuss palliative care options with those with terminal illness. And I guess my question is, first of all, is this going too far by imposing certain requirements on physicians? And also, do you think that this reinforces the notion that palliative care is only for terminal patients, since that was the sort of the verbiage in the law.
Dr. Gawande.
I am not thrilled with the idea of trying to mandate the way we should practice medicine by spelling it out in laws. On the other hand, the fact that there was felt to be the need to bring it into law indicates how poorly we've grappled with this issue as a profession. One of the things that Joe, the physician, who had called earlier raised, which presses on, I think, some of the tension here, is that I think there's embedded in this debate a question of whether this is an expertise that the palliative care physicians have and we need to refer patients to, or whether what they're describing is really just what great medicine looks like for people with complex, often terminal illness. And, my personal take on it, I'd be curious to hear what the others think, is that what this is about is saying, please have these discussions with patients about the fact that they are with a incurable illness that will end their life. And please discuss what their needs and wants are, and please help them achieve them. The fact that you have to put that in law is a kind of sadness. And I think that all of us in medicine have to be good. If I can be good at doing surgery and I can be good at providing medical therapies, there isn't reason I couldn't be great at this as well.
Thanks for your call.
I'd be curious about the others.
I appreciate it. We've had an email from Gloria who says, please talk about how important palliative care is for the caregiver, the family member, as well as for the patient. Dr. Meyer.
I think it's interesting that the family caregiver is so often ignored and not talked about in these discussions about cost and quality and patient-centered care, because when you think about it, the linchpin of the American healthcare system is the unpaid family caregiver, who basically is managing 99% of the illness themselves at home with very little support, and certainly no additional financial resources. And this is not a concern of policymakers because it's not something government pays for. Yet family caregivers pay an enormous price, not only financially, but also in terms of their own health and well-being, their own ability to remain part of their community and part of their extended family. And one of the great things about palliative care is that we see the patient and the family as our unit of care.
And Christina, that means that you bring the family member into each and every discussion?
It depends on the patient's relationship, but of course we like to encourage the family to be there, because if they're caring for that patient, it's important that they are a part of these conversations. Because as you, viewer had stated, that these caregivers are really carrying a lot of the burden. And at some point, they may be doing most of the management of these symptoms for the patients.
Here's an email, from Eric, who says, if more and more people choose palliative care rather than experimental treatments, will this hinder advances in medicine and the treatment of diseases? Dr. Gawande.
I don't think so. It's a small percentage of the population that chooses the experimental therapies. And the aim in these experiments is to is often involving people at a point in time where it can make sense to enroll in a trial of something entirely new, because there aren't a lot of options left. But what's missing, let me put it this way, we have a $2+ trillion system for making sure people have a chance at a lottery ticket for the miracle of survival from an incurable illness, but very little preparation for the likelihood that lottery ticket won't come in for you. And the fact that you're going to have discussions and help plan with people about what happens if the lottery ticket doesn't win doesn't mean you aren't offering that option and having some people go out and say, you know what, I want the lottery ticket, but I also want to be prepared for the more likely possibility.
Here's a fascinating email from Ellen, who says, my father was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Took me a few minutes on the internet to find out what his life expectancy was. His doctor told him he could cure his lung cancer. My father underwent terrible chemotherapy, had a terrible time, and died one day before the life expectancy time that I found on the computer. I can only imagine how his last 9 months of life might have been had he had the opportunity for palliative care. I learned from his experience that I would consider palliative care first if I was diagnosed with cancer, and hope I might have the grace of some period of relative health and be able to say goodbye properly to those I love. Dr. Meyer.
Nobody could have put it better, and I hope that those of us listening today heard that. It's about giving back control over choices and what your life's going to be like to the patient, who is, after all, the object of all this healthcare.
Let's go now to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, GP.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
My mom died of cancer. We had esophageal cancer. We did about 3 years of treatment, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, brachytherapy. And then two of my aunts as well died in cancer there in India. So I want to know how well this one is spread outside United States. If at all such a thing would have been there and knew what we were getting into, we wouldn't have even taken the treatment, because towards the end of the treatment, we found out that it was too late, and none of the doctors gave any clue that she was at a stage where she couldn't be treated.
Dr. Gawande, what happens outside the U.S.?
Well, my family is from India, and I have some familiarity with how the end comes for family members in a village or in a city in India. And, you know, in some ways, it can be like centuries past here. If there are not many options, people come together and provide what they can for comfort. The hard part is that in India you have, and in many of the growing economies of the world, you have the resources of technology growing and people wanting the access to that care. Cancer care has now become a global concern, for example, and trying to make sure that there is appropriate planning for end of life alongside it is just as much of a struggle in the poor settings as in the wealthy settings. And so this has to be a international phenomenon. One thing I want to voice, though, because there's a theme that's come through with a couple of these discussions, you know, there is value that does come from the chemotherapy and the surgery. This is not the either-or question. A first round of chemotherapy for a lung cancer patient significantly extends life and improves quality of care. Mm-hmm. It's when you get to the third round, the fourth round, it's when you're pushing and someone is now really sick and you haven't been willing to see the larger picture. That's when we start to really do harm.
Here's an email from Farah, who says, I'm a neurologist and palliative medicine specialist here in the Washington area. Our group published a small study in July in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, which showed decreased symptom burden with palliative care involvement. Our study was in private practice rather than the academic setting. Since I'm a neurologist, I want the panelists to comment on the value of palliative care for people living with chronic progressive disease like Parkinson's or dementia.
That's such an important question, because while the focus in growth in palliative care has been primarily in hospitals, the need is overwhelmingly in the community and in the physician's office and in the home, because let's think about it, 99% of a serious illness takes place at home and is the responsibility of the patient and the family. And if patients need to be able to access the kind of care that was studied much, much earlier in their disease course if they are going to reap the benefit in terms of quality of life and length of life. So we need to move palliative care upstream, out of the hospital, into the office practice and the home.
Does Medicare pay for palliative care?
Yeah. Just as Medicare pays physicians and nurse practitioners fee for service for a visit, I'm a geriatrician. If I see somebody for high blood pressure in my office, I get reimbursed. If I see that person at home for heart failure or shortness of breath, I get reimbursed for the home visit. So, yes, physicians and nurse practitioners do get paid under Medicare.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Jessica. Jessica, are you there? All right. What about Rochester, New York? Good morning, Vancey.
Hi. My question or comment dovetails the neurologist. I wanted the panel to comment. My mother is 80 years old, and she's dealing with end-stage diabetes disease, congestive heart failure, kidney failure, is recently now on dialysis. So nothing that medicine can do will cure her now. Her quality of life declines with every hospital visit. She's been admitted 5 times this year alone. But everything that you hear and doctors talk about, it's just about, you know, not just, but it's about very obvious terminal diseases. But when someone is dealing with such a long-term, slow illness, you know, I'd like to hear your comments about how to handle that.
Dr. Gawande.
Well, in many ways, you've got the experts on this here, and I'd love to make sure to give time for them.
Sure.
You know, the bottom line is that good doctoring involves helping your mother through what's to come and how to identify, you know, what's important to her when time begins to grow short. And then medicine and good medical care can help her achieve those things, even if it can't stop the disease.
Dr. Mack.
Yeah, Atul put it perfectly. I think the important thing is to sit down for a doctor or a palliative care clinician to sit down with you and your mom and other family members and ask, how has this been going for you over the last year? What's your day-to-day life like? What are the things that are most burdensome? What are the things that you're hoping for? And would you like to know what to expect in the next few months? And not everyone wants to know, but assuming your mother wants to know, then telling her and then asking her
what
how she wants to spend that time.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Christina Tafer, you also called in to long-term chronic illness situations, or are you strictly involved with cancer patients?
In my practice, I work with strictly cancer patients, so my expertise and experience is with cancer.
But now, is that broadening among nurse practitioners, palliative care for long-term chronic diseases, Dr. Meyer?
I'm a geriatrician, so my patients are all going to outlive me for sure, and they have multiple chronic conditions like heart failure, emphysema, memory loss, and they're all getting palliative care, and they're getting it for years.
Well, let's hope the practice expands. Dr. Diane Meyer, Christina Tafe, and Dr. Atul Gawande, thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.